Revolution Podcast. And today, I have with me, pretty excited. Like I've said before and several times on this show, I am not in a quest to find the hottest leftist on Twitter. But I do run across very, very, very interesting people via the internets. And I came across this gentleman through, I want to say, through Arash Kalahi, our show economist. I love calling him that. I will always call him that. But now he might have some competition. Dr. Asatar Baer is an activist, professor, teacher, and author of Prison Labor in the U.S. and Economic Analysis. He teaches economic theory at Riverside City College in Southern California. He has written over 200 articles for the Borsen Courier, I'm probably saying that wrong, Austria's oldest weekly financial newspaper. He has a YouTube channel with his lectures on economic theory, youtube.com/Asatar Baer. There will be a link in the description. In addition to economics, Dr. Baer also teaches meditation and served as the executive director of the Institute for Applied Meditation. Please welcome Dr. Asatar Baer.
Thank you. Well, yeah, you didn't set out to find the hottest leftist thinkers, but you have succeeded nonetheless.
I have. The Twitterverse is burning up right now with Dr. Baer's take. Listen, I'm going to read this take. What do you guys say? Hot take? Right. This is Dr. Baer's hot take, and I actually really, really, really like this. And we had, I will preface this by saying that before we even agreed to speak, I had saw other tweets he had before this one, before he got famous. He's officially internet famous. Do you need to read theory to be a communist? No, of course not. Being a communist is an honest, natural response to the brutality of capitalism and the feeling deep in your bones that there is a better way. What theory can do is help you articulate things. You can learn that there's a long-established discourse for most of what you thought of as your deepest and most revolutionary ideas, which is useful. You can learn that people have tried to put these ideas in practice and that the history of these efforts is complex and at the same time, highly ideological. And of course, you may learn something new, which is good itself. And another thing that Dr. Baer does do that I try not to do, but I do as well, he actually responds back to the people that have dumb shit to say to him.
Yes, well, I don't want to be elitist or exclusionary, you know, and if I cut out the people who said dumb shit, I mean, that would be, you know, you cut out a lot of people.
Especially on the internet.
The internet can be an angry place, and I get that, but, you know, you have to direct your anger toward the system, not toward individuals. Mm-hmm.
The now late Michael Brooks said, be ruthless against systems and be nice to people.
Yeah, that's where it's at.
And that's kind of where my head is at. To your point about not needing theory to understand communism. Communism is still to this day, even 2020, Soviet Union fell 40 years ago.
Yeah, I mean, 31 years ago, yeah.
And here we are still kind of red scaring the United States with fears of communism, dictatorships. What brought you into wanting to learn about Marx?
Well, you know, I think I had been leaning towards radical theory from when I was very young. I grew up in like a spiritual kind of subculture. My parents had studied Sufism, and so I grew up in like a kind of like a hippie commune, except it was in an urban environment. And so I was already kind of in this counterculture. You know, spiritual hippies are not necessarily political, though. There's like different subcultures in there, you know. But over time, I got just more and more interested in economic theory, and especially in radical economic theory. I don't know. I had some feeling that, you know, like the way that we're doing things isn't, you know, the only way. It's not even necessarily that good of a way. I mean, it's, you know, that it was very undeveloped and very inchoate, you know, but I think that's kind of how, you know, we all start in some way, you know, that something puts you on a certain direction. And I remember actually a book that had an impact on me. I got it from the library, and it was by H. Rapp Brown. And okay. I don't know if you heard of this book. I mean, H. Rapp Brown's a really interesting figure, you know, and has gone through like this whole arc. But it was called The Die, and then N-Word, and then Die. And I was like, and it had this picture of like this riot on the cover, and the lettering was in red. And I mean, and I read this book, and I was like, it's incredible, you know, because it was like it you know, he spoke so freely about something that you hardly ever hear about, you know, in that it's like when you learn about racism or the civil rights movement, it's always like this triumphal story, you know, like, like, oh, racism, that's what we used to have until we fought against it. And look, the civil rights movement. And it's like, you know, you read H. Rapp Brown and that's not what he's saying at all. You know, he's like, yeah, the struggle continues and it's connected to all these other things. And so that just kind of blew my mind in a way where it was like, hey, you don't have to be all reasonable and temper your tone and whatever all the time. You know, you can do this, right? So, you know, I just, it's like, I still remember that book, you know, and then I studied economics as an undergrad, and I was like, I don't get this. I mean, I don't understand this. There's something about this that just, you know, I felt like I was understanding the theory, I was doing well in it, whatever, but I was like, I don't get it. It seems like you're like willfully ignoring most of the important stuff here. And it wasn't until I discovered Marx. I mean, I was lucky enough, this is by accident, you know, but I went as an undergraduate, I went to the University of Massachusetts Amherst, and it just so happened that they had a very, you know, radical economics program that had been created in the 1970s and, you know, had a far-seeing dean back in the 70s said, wow, they, you know, kids today are really into Marxism, and we better get a few of these professors who actually do this. And so, you know, a lot of economics had been purged of its Marxist elements a long time before. But this is one of these rare instances where they went the opposite direction. So I had professors who taught Marxism and took it seriously. And I was lucky enough to be able to, you know, take that in as an undergrad. And that, you know, that was part of the process. And then I continued on in grad school. You know, I was like, well, since I'm usually you want to go to a different grad school than you did an undergrad, you know, and that's kind of the way you're encouraged and whatever. But I was like, I've got this great group of radical professors here. I want to study here, get my degree basically in Marxism. I mean, at one of the few places that you actually could. So I studied with Stephen Resnick and Richard Wolff, and Richard Wolff has really gone on to, you know, he retired from teaching. He taught for many, many years and, you know, is now a professor emeritus and whatever, and then created his own nonprofit, Democracy at Work, and is now, you know, has a much higher profile, you know, for his work on worker cooperatives and, you know, teaching people about socialism and communism. And So, you know, that's who I studied with. Rick Wolf was one of my dissertation advisors. And, you know, I learned a huge amount from both of them.
Talk about big figures on the left.
Yeah, really.
Yeah. He's like the go-to. Well, I don't know. I mean, I can only comment from my perspective, but I see him on even like Fox News.
Yeah, he's on Fox News. And it's really interesting. He says that he does very well on Fox News, that they just don't have really a category for him. You know, like their whole game on Fox News is to be like anyone who is even remotely liberal. They're like, well, you're a socialist. But then they meet a socialist and they don't know what to actually think of it. You know, they're like, well, he actually seems like a kind of a nice guy and he sounds smart and he says smart things. And they're like, huh, okay. You know, and I end up agreeing with a lot of what he says. So it's like, well, he's radicalizing Fox News, I guess.
When you portray these people as like these kind of comic book villains for so long, like, you know, I look, man, I'm not going to lie. There's a lot of bad television and bad movies that I still watch to this day that are embedded in my DNA, Rocky IV being one of them. But there's something kind of comical the way they portrayed the Soviet Union in that movie as this really cold place of no feelings. Like every character that was a Soviet in that movie literally is a robot.
Yeah, totally.
And you could say the same thing about like every other movie that came out during that time frame that was trying to paint some picture of this communist takeover. I mean, Red Dawn, another extremely popular movie from the mid-80s, is about the small island nation of Cuba and the Soviet Union taking over the world.
Right.
Like it sounds somewhat silly when you think about it, and not attacking Florida, but attacking the Midwest, Colorado.
Red Dawn's a classic.
Oh yeah, and they even remade it, and I think they used Koreans this time.
I haven't seen the remake.
I won't watch it. I also won't watch the remake of Karate Kid. Can't do it. I can't do it. So my big issue and what I try to do with even this show is to bring people in to get to know this leftist way of thinking, and get comfortable with it and kind of to start tearing down the walls of those Red Scare walls. How do you do it as a professor at a community college in kind of, you know, you're in the inner workings of California, you're in Riverside, you're not like in San Francisco or LA.
Right. I used to teach at San Francisco at City College. My arc as a professor is, I had wanted to work at a community college because I was like, you know, the way that you're encouraged, you know, as an academic is to try to, you know, I mean, academia is extremely elitist. You know, you're encouraged to try to find the most elite school that you possibly can, right? I mean, and study there and then teach there. And that's the way it works, right? I found myself in a very odd situation, like coming out of UMass. UMass Amherst is known in economics because, again, it has this radical reputation, right? And that touches everyone, you know, and it's known that UMass is a leftist program. So you have this kind of issue coming out of it where, you know, economists know that that is taking place. They know that you're going to have a certain politics, even though, of course, that varies. And, you know, it's... that's not great for your job market prospects. You know? It means that you're probably not going to get a job. I mean, elitism aside, Harvard hires people from Harvard, right? They don't hire people from UMass Amherst. That just is, you know,
it's silly.
Very rare that happens. I mean, occasionally one gets through. I actually have a friend, you know, there's usually other things that are involved in that, not to take away anything from the appointment or whatever, but you know, I was like, I don't want to go the elitist route. I want to teach to the people, you know? And to me, that meant community college. And so I was like, okay, I didn't have much experience with it. It was like this idealistic moment for me, you know, like I didn't actually go to a community college myself, you know, but I was like, yeah, I think I want this. And then I got a job initially, my first job out of grad school at RCC, taught there for 3 years, but my wife and I just really had this dream of like being in San Francisco. And so anyway, I got a job up there and we moved up there and, you know, taught at this, you know, wonderful institution. I mean, City College, RCC too. I mean, these are like very good, you know, highly funded institutions that really do serve the people. And I'm delighted to be a part of that. So, you know, that's where I'm coming from in terms of politics in the classroom. My main like role, obviously, as a professor is to facilitate the students' learning. You know, it's not to put a kind of an agenda on them, or you know, it's not so that people believe this, that, or the other. You know, it's that they understand the terms of the debate, that they see that there's a lot to learn. They see that there's a lot of ideology at play, and that they can think critically through those issues themselves. You know, I mean, where they end up on that, I mean, I think, you know, they're adults, right? I mean, what they end up believing is up to them. You know, I mean, I have my own opinions, obviously, right? You can't avoid that, and that's good. I tend to put it a little bit more in the background. I think, you know, if I'm teaching standard microeconomic theory, which is highly conservative, I mean, I'm going to try to give it the best reading that I can. I'm going to try to show its strongest argument. I will also then take it apart. I mean, I will present what I think of as the strongest critique, because to me, that's how you get a good education, right? You don't just stay with one argument, right? You say, well, what's the counter argument? You know? Mm-hmm. So I tend to, I don't shy away from it. I mean, if somebody was going to ask me, the thing is the students don't actually really know what to ask, you know, like their idea of politics is like, well, are you a Democrat or Republican or something like that? I mean, I don't necessarily encourage that question either. I don't, mm-hmm. I don't make a lot of like partisan digs on this or that, you know, whatever, because I just think, you know, that's not what they come to me for. Right. I mean, they're here to learn theory, you know? And that's mostly what I'll focus on. So I think that the students they don't actually really know. I mean, maybe they think I'm a Democrat or something. I don't know. I don't know exactly. I just think that's my approach. I would prefer to be, I'd prefer it to be a little bit less clear where I'm coming from personally, because that's not really what it's about, right? It's their education, not mine, right? I mean, it's, you know.
It's interesting that you say that you don't really like the kind of simplistic two-party conversation. There's, I don't know if you're paying attention to this. As we are speaking right now, October 16th, this episode will come out after that. The rapper Ice Cube, who you may know as the filmmaker Ice Cube, maybe you know him as a rapper Ice Cube. I don't know. I shouldn't pass judgment.
I know.
Yep. I'm sorry. So you know Ice Cube. You know Cube.
Yeah.
I'm not gonna lie, it's one of my favorites. I'm not even like that huge of a rap guy, but I have grown up listening to Ice Cube. He has definitely shaped the way I look at the world. I am a fan.
Yep.
That being said, 12-year-old Jason is not 43-year-old Jason when I look at a gajillionaire talking about politics. And he has recently gone into the same kind of political awakening, I would say, that a lot of Americans have post 2016. I feel like 2016 was a huge wake-up year for a lot of people. It was almost like we were in this Obama coma for 8 years.
Right.
And there's this like gigantic awakening because America is becoming this caricature of itself with this kind of buffoonish made in America as president.
Right.
And so Ice Cube apparently has this plan. I forget what it's called, like a platinum plan for colored people. Again, I'm saying it all wrong. And he presented his ideas to the Republican Party and the Democratic Party because he was like, look, both of you guys are full of shit as far as I'm concerned. And black people have these issues and you need to address them. And if you don't, then we're not going to vote for you. You're not going to hijack my vote. And, you know, I there's a certain perspective I appreciate. He was talking with like, what's her name? Is it Stephanie Kelton? Is the lady that does the MMT?
Yeah.
He was talking with her and he's learning all this stuff and he comes out and the Democrats apparently told him, well, we'll talk to you after the election about your ideas. And Donald Trump's party was like, well, we'll make a plan. Sure. What you got? And now he's like working with advising. I'm sure it's a kind of a lightweight role, the Trump administration. And a lot of people in the black community and kind of that follow pop culture at large are just divided and upset about it. And my main critique of the whole thing was, if you have a problem with the two-party duopoly, why didn't you go to all these other third parties or try to start your own? You could have went to the Green Party and said, hey, I got a platform, let's organize and do blah, blah, and blah. PSL. Yep. There's so many third parties that he could have went to that are literally on the ballot where he lives in California.
Right.
Or you have a humongous platform. You're Ice Cube. You have a gajillion records sold. You're a movie icon at this point in your life. But instead, you kind of, okay, which one of the big boys is going to validate my claim so I can huck something, be it debit cards for black people, prepaid phones, whatever the hell it is. I feel like he's going to huck something.
Yeah.
Have you followed that at all?
You know, I had heard that because it was trending on Twitter, right? I mean, so mm-hmm. I didn't dig as deep into the story. No, and I didn't realize that there was a kind of a whole plan that was being shopped around and stuff. I just was like, you know, I picked up on this vibe, like, oh, Ice Cube to now having some kind of role in like the Trump administration. You know, I mean, that definitely caught my eye. It sounds like it's a little bit looser of an association than that, which
is, yeah.
But yeah, I think you're right. I mean, you know, we get kind of like channeled into like, oh, well, where we Democrat or Republican, and it's just far too limited. I mean, I think that's the whole reason it's been created, honestly, is to limit our political engagement. I mean, you know, because capitalism has this problem, right? Which is, and the problem is called democracy, you know, like, how do you get masses of people to like vote for their own exploitation? You know, I mean, that's an interesting problem. I think the basic answer is propaganda, you know, and you have to convince people that this is somehow in their best interest. And, you know, you don't see a lot of anti-capitalist messages. You know, somebody pointed this out recently to me. They said, you know, that before like the 1990s, the word capitalism itself was never uttered in any mainstream media television like platform ever. And I was like, wow, that's interesting, right? Like, you can't even say the name of the economic system, you know?
You shall not speak its name.
Yeah, you shall not speak it. It is, you know? Just like how we, you know, we take air for granted and we don't talk that much about it necessarily, but, you know, we thank God it exists, right? Like, mm-hmm. It's like that kind of vibe, you know, and because we don't want there to be something called capitalism, because then that naturally raises the question, well, what is there besides that? You know, And we don't want that question being asked. And I think that's, so, you know, we've been channeled into this bullshit two-party system. And, you know, I mean, it's like Noam Chomsky says this, right? Like, we it'd be great if we had a second party. You know, we already have a pro-business party that happens to have 2 weeks. You know, like third party, it'd be nice if we had a second party. You know, it's like the Republicans are the offensive players that try to score, and the Democrats are like the goalies that prevent the left from scoring. But, you know, they're both on the same team. That they're they present themselves as being different, but they're not really different. And I think there's an enormous amount of dissatisfaction going on right now. I mean, maybe I'm just seeing what's in my own bubble, you know, but like on Twitter, I mean, I have had a Twitter account for years, but I haven't always done something with it. You know, I've kind of mostly let it languish. But when Bernie was campaigning, I got into it. I found burner Twitter, you know, and I was like, oh, this is fantastic. And then, you know, when COVID hit and Bernie withdrew, I mean, I think like burner Twitter was crushed. I felt it too, you know, even though in a lot of senses, Bernie was the compromise, you know?
I mean, that's somebody's Twitter handle. Bernie was a compromise.
And it's a good one. It's a good one. Who is the guy from The Coop really put it well, right? Where he said,
Boots Riley. Yeah.
Yeah. Boots Riley, where he tweeted and he said, look, you know, Bernie's as far right as I'm willing to go. Right. And, I mean, that was like a good way of putting it, you know, because you're like, okay, if you're on the left and you're in favor of a society that's based on sharing and cooperation, you know, there's certain concrete steps that you could take. And Bernie definitely supports some of those, but he's not going to be taking you the whole way, you know? I mean, it, like, he's not saying overthrow this system and the workers should own the means of production. He's not saying that at all, you know. But he is saying some of the things that you'd probably say if you wanted to get there. Like, everyone should be guaranteed a job, you know. Everyone should be guaranteed health care. You know, if we want to talk about, you know, fancy phrases from Marxist theory and, you know, the dictatorship of the proletariat, whatever, I mean, that's okay. I mean, I like that sort of thing because I'm steeped in it. But, you know, it's better, I think, to talk about some of the concrete policies because, you know, that gets support, you know? So I think you have to do both, basically. I don't know. I'm not sure if I'm answering a question anymore, but you have to talk about concrete politics. You know, you have to say, look, everyone should have a job at a decent wage, and here's what a decent wage is. You know, everyone should have healthcare. Everyone should have the right to an education. I like to work this one because I'm like, look, tuition being free, yeah, that's a step in the right direction. But school is work, you know, and you should be paid to do work. You shouldn't pay someone to do it. We need to stop that. But it shouldn't be free either, you know. You should be paid to go to school. I mean, it's an investment that society makes in society, right? I mean, that's what's happening. It shouldn't be privatized. It shouldn't be, oh, now I should pay tuition. I should carry a huge debt. Of course not, right? If you want people to take school seriously, then you pay them to do it. I mean, that's a simple, I think, point. But, you know, these are the kind of concrete policies, I think, that move us towards a society which is truly for the benefit of all, not one where we, you know, just funnel wealth into a few private hands.
And that's why I think it's so important to kind of profile people like yourself, because I see you as doing the big time legwork in communities that don't have the ability to go to Belgium and study Marxist theory. Like, I had a good friend that got to go to school overseas, and she was a bank regulator for quite a few years. And she was like, I learned Marx when I went to school there because it's just part of the curriculum. She goes, I never would have learned that if I just would have stayed in schools here, even elite institutions. So it says to me a lot when you are explaining to people exploitation because we just don't learn it from an economic standpoint. And what we learn in the inner city or poor neighborhoods is that you just got to make this money. And everybody supports you in that mindset.
Right, right.
The community will be behind you. If you have an exploitative plan, the community will be behind you. And when these, I don't necessarily think they're like bad people, like inherently bad. I just think that they are also part of a system that doesn't show them another way. Think that the only way out or any sort of liberation as a Black man or a marginalized person is to be the Black version of the oppressor is just kind of silly to me. Like, well, we need more Black Mark Zuckerbergs. It's like, why? Mark Zuckerberg's kind of a shitty dude. Like, why do we want different colored shitty dudes? Like, is that the post-Obama, post-racial world?
Yeah.
Is that what it's supposed to look like?
You see these debates going back. There's a long history of that too, like in the Black community. I mean, like Du Bois, Talented 10th.
Yeah.
That idea, or like, you know, the it's like the Booker T. Washington,
yeah.
Perspective, you know, and yeah, I mean, that gets a lot of support because it's pro-capitalist, you know, and it just says, look, capitalism gives everyone a chance. But, and, you know, I mean, that's the ideology of the system right there, you know, like, yeah, everyone has a chance, but not everyone will get there. And that's exactly really the cruelty of the system. It's not in giving you a chance. Only 3% of you are going to cross this river. Now have at it. The rest of you are going to die. Oh my God. Right. That's the frame of, yeah, but any of you could have a chance to make it. Most of you won't. I mean,
you had access to the river. You have
access to the same chance to cross it. It's structural cruelty. I mean, and I think this is like hard for us to wrap our heads around because we're so trained in individualism, you know? We're like, oh, that dude shot this other dude, you know? And like, okay, yeah, that's true. But that's not the end of the story, is it? I mean, you know, both of these people lived in poverty, you know, and one was taught that the only way out is to seize every opportunity and to use violence if you need to. I mean, that's a situation where violent death is going to be pretty much inevitable. I mean, you don't know who's going to do it when exactly, but you know it's going to happen, right? I mean, and that's harder for us to grok, you know, because we're so focused on individual action and so little of our attention gets put on the system, you know, and what are the incentives of that system?
And when we're so focused on individual action, then we can't really see, and this is just my opinion, we can't really see the flaws of the system as a whole. I worked with the unhoused community, and I actually lived across the street from an extremely large encampment. And a lot of the complaints that you hear come from like, well, these people over here just don't want it. They like it there.
Yeah.
I was like, well, think about that for a second. Like, what would make someone like living with rats and not having a place to use the bathroom?
Right, right.
You know, what conditions did they come from where this becomes normal? And how does one get out of that? It isn't sheer will.
Right, right.
You know, we're not going to read The Secret and the next day find a house.
Yeah.
So, and that leads me actually into my next big question for you. You actually wrote a book about prison labor, and you questioned, is prison labor slavery?
Yep.
And before we just get into prison labor, I'm assuming that you have a critique of the prison system as a whole.
Well, yeah. I mean, this, of course, how could you not? You know, I mean, this is a thing that, so when I was a grad student, there were these courses, you know, so as a grad student, I was a teaching assistant, right? And and then there was also an opportunity to become what was called a teaching associate, which is like, you know, an adjunct basically that you could do as a grad student. And, you know, you got a tuition waiver and whatever, and they paid you a small amount. And grad students, you know, being very creative and highly political and whatever at UMass, had introduced some really interesting courses, and these were like special topics courses, and they were courses that professors didn't necessarily really have the expertise to teach, but because somebody had done the paperwork and had introduced this course, it was like nominally on the books, and sometimes they get offered anyway. And one of these was called The Culture and Economics of U.S. Prisons. And I was like, wow, this looks fascinating. Like, what is this course? Who teaches this course? And, you know, I saw it was being offered, and I asked our department chair, and he was like, well, this is created by a grad student. We don't actually have somebody to teach it. Are you interested? You know? And I was like, well, I don't know if I know that much about this topic. I mean, I have to educate myself. And I went and talked to the grad student who created it, Tony, great guy, Tony Guglielmi. And he said, okay, these are the texts I use. This is where I go with it. And so this was just like a huge moment for me as a student, because I was going into this and saying, you know, I think this area is important, but I'm going in really as a student. You know, it's not really a field that I know even that much about. I'm trying to educate myself. And so I taught this course for some years as a grad student. It was hugely popular. I mean, because, you know, this was like the late 90s. And so the prison system had gone on this huge growth tear, you know, and it was just starting to be kind of recognized and studied at the time that this was happening. There were all kinds of great critical resources coming out, and along the way, some of it was about prison labor. And, you know, most of like the critics and whatever were coming from the left, right? And so there was a very strong inclination to say, look, the prison labor is just slavery. And, you know, here's a cataloging of some of the abuses that happen. And I was like, you know, okay, I can kind of see this. And then I started to see, well, what are people saying on the other side of this, you know, because there was a whole like set of arguments that said prison labor is not slavery. And so I studied those, and then I started thinking like, you know, no one is really making a very systematic argument here, like a real like social science type of argument. Like when you start off, you have to kind of say, well, what is slavery? You know, like, I mean, if you're going to say something is or isn't, you know,
like how would you define it?
Yeah. And then you have to say, well, what are the characteristics of this particular system vis-a-vis other systems? Right. And, you know, you have to do some theory. You have to look at history. And so that actually seemed worthwhile to me, because I felt like that, you know, that the critics were making almost more of an aesthetic argument, you know, like, oh, this seems like slavery, doesn't it? Like, look at it. Right. And I'm like, I just, you know, that's not a very strong argument. I want a good definition, because, you know, hey, there are people who are defending this, right? There are, and you have to deal with their argument. Like they want to say things like, well, the inmates get paid wages, so slaves don't get wages, you know? So, you know, for me, it was like, all right, let's look into this in a more detailed fashion. Let's study the history, and let's actually make, you know, a comprehensive argument. So that's what I did. That was my dissertation, and it came out of that sense of like, wow, we're spending an absolutely outrageous amount of social resources keeping people in cages, and prison labor is a piece of that, right? I mean, it's not the whole reason for why prisons exist by any stretch, you know. So, you know, there was a lot of stuff I could have gotten into or could have said, but I looked at the prison labor piece and said, you know, that's an area where there aren't very many people working on it, you know, and I think I can maybe add something.
And in that, you really break down a lot of different facets of prisons and labor. And I did watch your YouTube video, which I will be linking in the description.
Cool.
It's about 43-minute video of Dr. Baer kind of going over, I would say, a synopsis of the book. Would you say that's what it is?
Yeah, I mean, parts of it, you know.
So when we think of prison labor, I think a lot of people think of like private prisons as being the problem, since that's what really got highlighted in Michelle Alexander's book, The New Jim Crow.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. I don't know if you checked that book out or.
Yes, that's a good book. My focus is not on the private prison necessarily. I think, you know, that's a problem. But even without that, you know, like some of the worst prisons are state prisons, you know? I mean, I think it causes a certain extra discomfort to be like, oh, now we're outsourcing this to corporations and involving the profit motive. Could that not have to, doesn't that have the potential to make things worse, you know? And I think, yeah, it does. But, you know, the state-run system is already pretty bad, you know? I mean, like, it's not like, oh, if everything was state-run, it'd be great. No, I don't agree with that whatsoever. So my thing is more like, can we create a theoretical container, you know, that can understand any of these different permutations, you know, like whether it's a state prison or a private prison or whatever is going on in terms of the labor, how do we characterize the labor process? And, you know, the basic way I went about this is to say, you know, slavery, or what I call the slave fundamental class process, I'm using a Marxist, class analysis in order to understand this, you know. So from the Marxist perspective, it's like, who performs the labor in society? That's like the key entry point, right? At a particular point of production, who produces surplus? And so surplus is defined by that which is above the needs of the direct producer. So the necessary surplus labor distinction. Now, in prisons, this is complicated because prisons involve welfare, right? Like the inmates receive a whole bundle of consumption goods, regardless of whether they perform labor or not, right? So that's what we mean by welfare, right? Like it's a universal provision. And so
housing,
exactly.
Food, healthcare.
Exactly, right. And you know, this is pretty rare to find that in the United States, right? The forms of welfare that we have are fairly weak, right? I mean, we have like aid to families with dependent children, right? We have SNAP, we have Social Security, right? All of these are limited forms of welfare, right? But they're not necessarily all that comprehensive, right? I mean, like talk to somebody whose only income is Social Security, right? Like, do they have are all of their needs met by that, right? I mean, it's certainly better than nothing, right? But prison has a very comprehensive form of welfare, and that has to be taken into account because the needs of the inmates, you know, for food, clothing, shelter, and many other things are met, right? So
And this is where I hate to cut you off, and let's table that point that you're making, because this is where I think a lot of the argument comes into play. As I was telling Dr. Bear off air, I was having a discussion with someone, family member, and they volunteer at a youth facility here in the Bay Area, and their point was there was some protesting going on in California. There's been people protesting the prison system. There's definitely been a lot of COVID problems with the way the wardens are handling everything. That's a whole nother topic for a whole nother show. And they've been calling for the release of a lot of prisoners. And also there's that whole ICE component where a lot of people are getting released, literally serving their time, and then going to another ICE facility, then getting kicked out of the country as a whole. The Guardian did a great piece on that. I can link that. But their point was that this youth facility for a lot of kids was better than home, quote unquote. Therefore, the youth facility is a good place. And I've also heard that argument for prison, where you'll hear, usually you hear this from law enforcement, well, these people are going to steal so they can go to jail and actually get a bed for the night or the month or whatever the situation may be. So to your point about welfare, quote unquote.
Yeah. To me, these are arguments for communism that I'm hearing. You know, they're just in a very distorted form. Like, should we allow people to perish because they can't afford food? Should we allow people to sleep on the street because they can't afford rent? I mean, is that okay? Does a civilized society do that, right? I mean, I don't think so, honestly. I think it's pretty clear. Like, we have the wealth to give everyone the basics, right? We can give everyone a decent life. And why don't we, you know? I mean, like, let's ask the question that way, you know? Let's not start with, okay, well, society is like this and blah, blah, blah. Well, no, that's not a good place to start, right? Because the way that society is organized is absurdly cruel, right? We don't start there. We start with, what should it look like, you know? I mean, that provides some clarity, you know? And so to me, like, the thinking that says, like, oh, yes, right, these people want to be incarcerated because then they get a hot meal. It's like, yeah, you're starting in the wrong place, and it's giving you a very distorted idea of things, right? Like, you're starting with the idea that, look, some people are just going to starve, right? Some people are just going to be homeless. I don't accept that as a starting point, you know? I think that's a pointlessly cruel starting point. I think we could do a lot better than that.
Yeah, and I think that's the problem with that discussion, that I feel like they start it there because, you know, back to your comments about the political education that we get here in this country, because we don't have the ability to give it a deeper look and ask, well, why is that person in the situation in the first place?
Right.
Why is this child in a situation in the first place where they would want to be locked up in a facility? Because my first reaction when I heard that was, why don't you put your kids in jail then? Why don't you just, that sounds like the greatest daycare ever, the way you're describing it. So why don't you just put them in there? And of course, responsible, if I wasn't, no, why don't you right now put your kids in there? Because you don't want your kids in jail. There's bad people in there. It's a horrible environment.
Right.
But, you know, sorry. I was excited to talk to you, having that conversation like a couple of days ago. I was like, oh man, I really can't wait to talk to Dr. Bear about this. Because I'm sure you get that a lot from even the kids that you teach when you first start talking about this stuff.
What I think is, you know, one of the things that I talk about in the argument is how are we constructing people in our discourse, right? So when we talk about prisons and we talk about anybody who's incarcerated, the category is the criminal, right? And what do we mean by that? What is that category, right? I mean, this is the most despised, you know, most objectified, most alienated category that we have, you know? I mean, like, I think part of the awakening of, you know, feminism and anti-racist advocacy is to say, look, there's a lot of insults and slurs that we can no longer use in good conscience, right? We're not going to accept it. It's not, you know, these have being denormalized, right? We're not going to accept somebody being called the N-word, right?
Yeah.
I mean, and that's a good development, right? I mean, that's a very good development. It's not enough, but it's a step in the right direction, right? You know, but are we cool with calling somebody a criminal and basically meaning somebody who's less than human? Yes, we are. We're very cool with that. We're fine with that, right? I mean, it is one of the, you know, dehumanized categories that we allow to continue. We haven't really questioned it, you know, to the extent that we have, you know, these other you know, horrible slurs, right? And so that is important, right? Especially when it comes to slavery, because what we know is there's a long held understanding about slavery, which is that the slave is dehumanized, the slave is objectified, the slave is in important ways less than human. You know, the Romans even had this category, a special category in their legal system, in their law, called a res, meaning a person thing, you know, like a slave is not really a person in Roman law, but still, you know, can think and can, they create a category for that, right?
And subhuman category.
Yeah, a subhuman category, exactly. And then it's like, well, okay, yes, of course you can enslave that person. And that is, you know, to the extent that we admit that there's slavery in prisons, that is the way that it's justified. And I just think that's really interesting, and that deserves to be questioned, you know, because it exists in a very uneasy relationship with other things that we say, which is that, you know, a person can serve their time, a person can get rehabilitated, a person can realize they made a mistake and choose a different way, right? I mean, we believe in that culturally as well, right? But then it's like, oh, well, that person's a criminal. I mean, that's a label that you can never, ever escape from, you know? And I think that plays a role, right? Because we permit the enslavement of inmates because they're in that category, right? I mean, it's even written into the law on the constitutional level, right? I mean, we can look at the 13th Amendment that says, you know, there will be no slavery nor involuntary servitude except as punishment for a crime, right? That's our great loophole.
And it's interesting because I feel like the criminal moniker stays with you, right?
Yeah.
So even after you're released from serving your time and being subject to your slave labor, it almost puts you in a position to do very similar work on the outside.
If you can get a job. I mean, I think that's the difficulty this so rarely appears in movies, but since we were talking about 80s movies a little bit earlier, I don't know if this is probably a 90s movie, but the movie I'm thinking of is the movie Heat. You've seen that one, right?
Yeah, Robert De Niro and Al Pacino.
What a great
Val movie. Kilmer, yeah.
It just has a very brief scene in it where, you know, it's one of the sad stories that happens, right? Is they're like one of the members of their squad is an ex-con, right? And he comes out of the joint. And he knows how to cook, right? And so he gets a job at a restaurant. It's like a short order cook or something. And they're like, yeah, we're going to pay you this, right? And it's like way below the minimum wage, right? They're like, yeah, we're gonna say that we're paying you the minimum wage, but we're paying you really this. And you're not going to say anything about it. Otherwise, we'll say you stole something. I mean, they've got him completely over a barrel, right? I mean, he's like, okay, you know? But then he, you know, I don't want to give any spoilers. You guys should watch Heat, okay?
You know, you can give a spoiler because Heat's like 20 years old. And if you haven't seen it by now, then you deserve to get the ending spoiled.
That this guy gets killed, you know, in the heist. So, you know, you should still watch it. I'm just telling you, tearjerker warning, you know?
I believe that's Danny Trejo, right?
The guy.
The actor?
Who plays that guy? I don't think so, because it's like African-American character.
Was it a black guy? I thought Danny Trejo was in that movie too. Who was the black guy in Heat?
He's in a lot of those gangster style movies, you know.
I haven't seen Heat in a minute.
Yeah.
I do remember really loving Heat, and there's a really great scene with Pacino and De Niro kind of facing off. But yeah, there's. I worked with a lot of guys that were formerly incarcerated for some heavy fucking crimes.
Right.
At one of these emergency room key shelters in Oakland. And these guys had some of them had like administrative roles.
Mm-hmm.
And one day, one of us lower tiered people were having an issue. And this one guy said, he's like, well, of course he's going to protect the hell out of his job, man. What do you think? What other options does he have?
Right.
Other than working in this world? You know,
yeah,
they can't be outraged by labor violations like you, Jay.
Yeah.
He's not going to fall into another six-figure a year position after being incarcerated for 30 years.
I mean, it limits your options so much. It's just, but you know, even that idea, right? The idea that, you know, there's a private labor market and not everyone is going to get a job, right? There are going to be some people who just cannot find employment, right?
Mm-hmm. And
I mean, it's like a massive, you know, version of like, I don't know. What's that game where there's not enough chairs? What is that called? I forget.
Oh, shit.
I mean, somebody's going to be left out.
I can't think of the name. Yeah.
You know? And I, you know, prison to some extent soaks that up, right? I mean, that's the way Marxists have looked at prison for a long time. They said capitalism generates a reserve army of the unemployed, you know, a lumpen proletariat, a group of people whose, you know, skills or whatever, right, combined with, you know, the prejudices against them or whatever it is, right, for being poor or you name it, right? I mean, there's a grab bag of social prejudices out there, right? And so, you know, people who are not going to really be able to put together a living, that's existed throughout the history of capitalism for various reasons, right? How do we keep that group controlled? That group has very little to lose, you know? Well, incarceration is one of our big answers in the United States. And, you know, I mean, I think that's not a surprise to hear me say that, right? I think it makes a certain amount of sense. But that doesn't mean that that's an acceptable answer, right? I mean, it's like putting a Band-Aid on a gunshot wound, you know? I mean,
you
stop the bleeding, you know? Like, why on earth do we have not enough? Why have we created that structural scarcity when it doesn't exist, you know?
So what is our step moving forward to address these prison labor issues?
Well, I mean, I think the problem is that a lot of things are now getting worse, right? I mean, we have not just the problem of like of incarceration. We also have, you know, ICE, right? We have the problem of trying to incarcerate immigration away, which is also pointless and cruel. I mean, you know, we know that from studying the issue, we know that walls and we know that harsh enforcement is not going to stop immigration. You know, this is a structural issue. You know, it has to do with, you know, I mean, if there's a single country that's done more to destroy the infrastructure of Latin America, I mean, it's the United States, you know, causing chaos in all of these countries. And then we get mad when a few people want to flee the chaos and enter the United States. I mean, that's just incredibly, you know, disingenuous as a position. And then to say we're going to have these massive detention centers, to see the kind of brutality that's happening in these detention centers, I think, you know, that's something that has to be resisted and protested to the utmost. So I think that's very much an action item, you know, for me.
Is part of our job to humanize incarcerated people?
I think that is part of it, yeah. And that's an important counter to the idea that, you know, it's like we're taking apart the criminal as a category and saying that, well, I mean, you know, there's just people after all, right? it's not a real category anyway. But I think what's really promising right now is that abolition of police and prisons is beginning to be understood as a position. I mean, that was an incredibly marginalized position for decades. And Angela Davis, I mean, fantastic, theorist, and has really, been working this for decades and decades. And now that argument is really getting a lot more attention, and it's really worth pondering, what are the things that make us feel safe, that provide that? Do they, and is that true for everyone, right? I mean, because many people look at the police and don't see safety,
Yeah.
That says danger, right? Because, I mean, we've seen the videos, I mean, there's a good reason that doesn't say safety to everyone. What would make us safer, That's a good question to ask right now.
David Graeber, the late David Graeber, called them bureaucrats with weapons.
Yeah, totally.
Well, I don't know if you watched any of this, and by the time this airs, we'll probably have announced, maybe, I'm sure this count is going to take a while, a new president. But I saw some clips from the last debate, or not one debate, I guess it was two dueling town halls, which is the level of political theater that we are at in 2020 with mainstream media, which is pretty awesome, I guess.
Right.
Joe Biden was asked about defunding the police, and he doubled down on shooting people in the leg, which I thought was, I literally laughed. Because that approach to policing, like it's a TV show.
Yeah.
Like, well, just shoot him in the leg. Like, what do you, don't have to kill him, shoot him in the leg. It's fine. It's a leg shot.
I think anybody who's ever been shot anywhere would disagree with that. But, you can certainly die from getting shot in the leg. I mean, there's no question. I mean, there's, I feel like this is like, it's like as if our political discourse were just a Hollywood movie, where, oh yes, of course you can knock somebody out by giving them a light tap on the head with the butt of a pistol or something, or, oh, you shoot somebody in the leg and they fall down and no ill effect comes of it, And it's like, that is just cartoonish nonsense, the fact is there's no good place on the human body to be shot, there's no good place. I mean, yeah, there's places that are more lethal and less lethal, but that's not what we're talking about here, right? I mean, that is like you've already seeded all the ground. And I mean, like, so for you to say that example, I think you're right. That is the level of our discourse, Our discourse is not being led by the politicians that claim to be our leaders,
No,
because the whole culture is saying, hey, look, we have an enormous problem with racism in policing, with violence in policing, with shooting first, asking questions later. That's a huge problem. And here's 1,001 videos, each one sadder than the next, that show that's a real problem. And then, what are the supposedly left candidate is up there saying, well, I don't believe in defunding the police. They should have more funding. And it's like, yeah, I mean, that's not leadership, that's a very conservative position, right? So I don't know. I mean, I think that kind of gets at your theory of history, is history created by great men who do stuff, or does it come from, the consciousness of millions? I mean, I don't know. We definitely have been trained that it's one person. Individual kind of view.
Well, right now we have a president that thinks that Howard Zinn's History of the United States is a bad book because it does not paint all white people in a good light.
Yeah, right.
I was like, wow, that's pretty awesome that you think that. Like, that's what you got from that book. Like, reading that first chapter is kind of like, holy shit, Columbus is not a cool dude. And you getting like, you know what? What's he got against Columbus?
But, you know, before you saw that, would you have put money on that, that Donald Trump knows who Howard Zinn is?
Thank you. I look at Donald Trump as like this guy, and a lot of people disagree with me. I think a lot of people put way too much stock in the stuff that he says, because you can't call him this extreme narcissist on one hand, and on the next hand have like 8-hour discussions about how he's playing this 3-dimensional chess with the media. He's not. They're just, he makes money. He says things that make them money, and that's kind of the end of the story. People get clicks. People get eyeballs on screens when this fool talks. If we decided that the bullshit that Donald Trump said was worthless, he'd shut up.
Yeah. I mean,
but because we put more value on him saying shit about Howard Zinn than we put on fucking Howard Zinn.
Yeah, well, I mean, a people's history of the United States is a lot longer than a tweet by Donald Trump. So, I mean, the thing is, we have to kind of give Trump his due for having like very good populist political instincts. It's just that he is taking the easy route of populism, which is, you know, all of these things which are part of our history and part of our culture. I mean, everything from, you know, toxic masculinity to like traditional gender roles to like a very, you know, rigid form of Christianity, you know, a very like rule bound, you know, look at that religion. And mm-hmm. that is like, these are tropes in our culture, you know, but they're the past, right? I mean, regardless of what Donald Trump says or tweets or whatever, are we going back into a world of in which there's traditional marriage and only two genders? I personally don't think so.
No, I agree with you.
I mean, the culture's moved on those issues, and that forces everyone to grapple with it, right? And those are good movements, right? Those are movements which are better for human expression and human freedom, you know? And I mean, I don't even think conservatives would disagree with me on that, you know? Like if we ask libertarians, hey, should men be allowed to wear dresses or whatever, right? I mean, like you know, you can make a pretty strong conservative case for that too, you know? So I think that we're in a backlash moment, basically, you know, where we've seen progress in a lot of areas, and then it's kind of natural to see like a backswing.
Yeah, and he speaks to that that kind of maybe they feel forgotten, maybe they're tired of their kids yelling at them and telling them how like inappropriate they are.
Yeah,
but I feel like the cure for Donald Trump is to make them watch the Cobra Kai series on Netflix.
I've been watching that.
That to me is like the cure.
Oh, when his sensei comes back, you know, after like you thought he was dead, and then he's back.
Yeah,
the old douchebag is back.
and it's like his relationship with this little Latin kid.
Yeah,
is what makes him realize like, oh, I've been saying and doing bad things.
Yeah.
Like that was, I don't know. It is a bit corny, or it's definitely a throwback to all those 80s shows and movies that I love oh so much. But the spin they put on it of this out of touch man not reveling in how out of touch he is, but kind of like, this kid is giving him a tad bit of shame for it.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's like all like, oh, you actually care about me, so I don't want to be a bad guy. Like, I feel like you can use that for people that fall down the Trumpian rabbit hole of I hate everything that isn't from 1954.
Yeah. I see this a lot like with my students, that like there's a desire to just not worry about things and want to feel good and like be strong. And like, who gets into this, right? It's the young white men, right? Mm-hmm. Because they're not getting those messages with the kind of universal volume that they're used to, right? They're getting messages that say, oh, wow, actually the history of my ancestors is a lot more complex and a lot more negative than I thought, you know, and how does that make me feel about me and who I am? And, you know, and I have to change certain aspects of my thinking and my language. And, you know, I mean, this is a difficult stuff, but it has to happen, you know, mm-hmm. because we are awakening to the truth is, look, you know, this is a heavily racist authoritarian society, you know, and we are not at peace with that in the same way as we once were, you know. I see those as positive changes, but I think there's a certain segment that's like, no, we want to go back. And I think that that's part of what's given us Trump, you know, and I think he's aware of that to some level, like when he says like, yeah, we want to teach history in a way that's a lot more celebratory or something. I mean, I'm like, well, you can't do it honestly then, you know, if you're going to be honest with your history, you can't celebrate it.
And haven't we been doing that for the last umpteen years?
Yeah, right.
Like last I checked, I didn't learn any of this shit in school. Yeah. I didn't know who Marx was.
Right.
You know, Ronald Reagan saved the Soviet Union and tore down the wall, even though it happened after his administration.
My kids are 10 and 13. And so they're like, you know, in California public education system. And, you know, like I read, like just even what do they get about like medieval feudalism? I mean, you would think that this is such a long time ago that we don't have to like, I don't know, sugarcoat it or something, but it is heavily sugarcoated. You know, they get the idea that serfs and lords helped each other and looked out for mm-hmm. each other. And I'm like, are you kidding me? Like, you're not even going to learn about the corvée labor system and that the serfs had to work a certain number of days of the week for free on their master's land. Like, you're not even going to make an attempt to teach that. It's not like it's super complicated, you know?
But that goes back to your point of like understanding the inner workings of the system that they're in now, because capitalism is definitely akin to feudalism.
Right, right. Yeah. I mean, that's Marx's argument right there. Like Marx starts with the history and then says, well, we've got a different form of exploitation going on, but you know, you don't want to substitute a new form for an old form. You know, it would be like saying, hey, stop beating that person with a bat. That's wrong. I'm going to beat you with a belt instead. It's like, what? How about?
and then there's going to be a bunch of people trying to reform the beatings. Can the belt just be thinner?
Yeah. You know?
Just a thinner belt.
Thinner belt.
That's all we need is thinner belt. Thinner belts. Thinner belts.
Or maybe it's thicker. I mean, because thinner can cut you, you know? I don't know.
just can we just reform it in some way, shape, or form? Can you put a body camera on as you beat me?
Do you remember that old sketch by Bill Cosby that's about being threatened with a beating by his dad?
Mm-hmm. From Bill Cosby himself?
Yeah, that right.
Yes.
And he's like, we had never seen the belt, but we'd heard about it. You know, the belt was 7 feet long and 9 feet wide. Tear the flesh off your bones and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
That image has just always stayed with me for some reason. I know we're not supposed to talk about Bill Cosby anymore, but
Oh yeah, look, man, Bill Cosby is, if you are a colored person that's my age or slightly younger, Bill Cosby was such an important part of your upbringing.
Yeah.
And where the charges against him, it broke my heart that this man that I to a degree looked up to,
right,
could be a party to such like just over the top vile behavior.
I know.
It's really sad.
Yeah.
But that's the complex nature of humans. And we can't sit here and act like, and there's people that want to do that. Like, well, you can't talk about Bill Cosby. It's like, well, look, I know people that went to black colleges that went to college because of growing up watching the Cosby Show and then A Different World. So
yeah,
we can't, throw his entire legacy away. You know what I mean? It's a complex legacy, and we have to be able to analyze it as that complex legacy.
Right.
So, I mean, I'm not going to sit around here wearing a Bill Cosby t-shirt.
I think you could probably get away with wearing a Fat Albert t-shirt, though.
I wouldn't even do that.
You wouldn't even do that? Yeah.
Not in 2020. No. Yeah. No. It's just, it comes with a lot.
Yeah.
And I don't want to have that conversation every time somebody sees me like, You know, he voiced all of the characters. I was like, ah, oh, shit. Even Rudy.
Like, you're like, school in the summer, no class.
Yeah, like, I can't, man. I can't. And he had his hand in so much as well, as far as like filmmaking.
Right.
In the 70s. Not just acting in them, but like giving money to up and coming filmmakers like Melvin Van Peebles.
Yeah.
So again, it's a complicated legacy.
Very complicated.
You know, what do we say about Michael Jordan, LeBron James? I think these guys have somewhat complicated legacies as well.
I mean, Michael Jordan is like, I feel like there's one part of his legacy, which is he's known for kind of always dodging the issue of like the sweatshops, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Because that was brought up to him several times and he's, oh, well, I'm gonna have to look into that, you know? And there was never any, you know, there was never any like, here's what I learned, you know? It was just like, I want to keep dodging that forever, you know?
Yeah, because he made it about, and it became about this kid who wasn't really grow up poor, but that became a gajillionaire.
Yeah.
And that goes back to my original point about Ice Cube and the give us more money so we can be equally as exploitive as our white brothers and sisters.
Yeah.
Which, I don't know. Well, on that sad note, Dr. Bear, sadding everything up. Do you have anything you want to promote or shout out?
Well, you know, people are interested in, you know, learning more about economic theory. I do have a YouTube channel. You know, you can go and check that out. These are lectures that I give in my classes. So they're kind of like the opposite of those short, you know, videos that you see on YouTube that explain something in 3 minutes. You know, these are longer videos that go.
You're getting the full-on lecture, people.
Yeah, you're getting a full lecture, and that's because, you know, that's what it's about. And, you know, if people want to check out my book, the Prison Labor in the United States, Economic Analysis, you know, the book is unfortunately kind of expensive. That's a decision that was made by the publisher, not by me. But I do have, like Jason mentioned, I do have a YouTube video which makes the case that I make in the book that prison labor is best understood as a form of slavery. And that, you know, by that rationale, slavery was marginalized in the United States in 1865, but it wasn't actually abolished, that it's continued in prisons, you know, to a lower extent, definitely, but it's continues to this day. And that's something that we need to, you know, try to grapple with, right? We need to understand that. Does that fit with our notion of who we are and where we're going as, you know, as American people?
Mm-hmm. Wow. I like watching his lectures because it makes me feel like I'm back in school and I need that in my life. I'm being totally serious. I actually have a question for you. Would you be down? I do a live stream. I think this is the one day you can't do it. I do a live stream every Tuesday. Would you be down to do a live stream with me?
Sure. Yeah, I'll do a live stream with you. But what does that mean exactly? Does that mean people write in with questions and things like that?
Questions and comments, live time.
Yeah. Okay. Sure.
Okay. You heard it. Right. You said it. You said it is recorded. It's real. You can't dodge it now.
Write in your questions, people.
Thank you very much for taking the time to talk to me today, Dr. Bear. You're going to hear some music. Please don't hang up.
All right.